Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. It's been a pretty mild December so far, but we'll see the official start of winter next week. So before conditions force most of us indoors, we're taking a look outside. This hour, we'll see how one local organization has made the outdoors more accessible to us with their work in area parks. And we'll look at how businesses can help preserve birds of prey through their landscaping. We start today with a subject we visit from time to time. That's our trees. In past shows, we've examined a crucial role they play in the environment and how to get them through a drought like the one we saw just a couple of years ago. Well, today we look at how we can help trees survive a tough winter. And here to help us is Chuck Connor. He's an urban forester with the Missouri Department of Conservation. He's based in Lee Summit. And Chuck, great to have you back here again. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome, Steve.
Well, other than a severe ice storm, some people may think trees are fine throughout the winter, Chuck, but I mean, after all, most of them are dormant. So let's start with the most obvious of winter conditions, and that's the cold weather. At what temperature can cold really begin to threaten a tree?
Well, it depends. If you're talking about our native trees in this area, cold really doesn't threaten them, Steve, unless you get an abnormal cold, low temperature.
Abnormal means what?
Something we haven't seen in our lifetime.
Okay. That's what
because
abnormal is.
When you think about it, you know, if you walk by a big bur oak, that tree can be anywhere from 200 to 300 or more years old. And look at the amount of cold winters that tree has gone through. So since they're native, they're adapted evolution-wise to our climates, and nothing really hurts the trees. In fact, for woody plants, fluctuations in temperatures, when we get the 55-degree weekends we had this weekend followed by, back down to 20, are much more harder for that organism than just having 20 degrees all winter long.
Oh, that's so interesting. And it's harder because why?
Because certain for instance, a lot of people will have red maples. And they have what's called sun scald or frost cracking on the southwest side of the tree. And what happens is you get a warm, sunny day, and the water and sap start to flow up the tree in the trunk. And then either a cloud can pass over the sun or the sun will go down and that temperature plummets. And we all know when water freezes, it expands. And when it expands in the trunk of the tree, it actually fractures those vessels or veins, for a layman's term, and the tree can then, in the spring, it can no longer get water up that side of the tree, so it cankers or dies on that section. So it's a fluctuation, warm, cold, and the speed of those fluctuations that are more harder on our trees than just an average cold temperature.
Well, you explained that so well, Chuck, but I'm thinking that, you know, these days, aren't we seeing more of what you just described, these warmer temperatures followed by a cold snap and then a reversal of that?
I have no idea what an average winter, spring, or summer is anymore. It's just a wait and see. It's been very difficult on our woody plants, especially you mentioned at the beginning of the show, the drought of 2012. I've had more phone calls on trees dead because of that than anything else, and I will continue to get those for the next several years.
I was going to say those calls are continuing right?
Yes, trees store energy or food for a layman's term, and they can use that bank over several years until it goes bankrupt, and we will be seeing trees dying from that 2012 drought for the next several years.
Are you seeing any effects of, you know, people talk about climate change, and again, going back to this notion of warmer days followed by cold snaps, followed by a sudden warming trend, are you seeing tree stress as a result of those kinds of things?
I wouldn't say that. As far as changes in climates, what I have seen is we are now starting to plant trees in our area that 20 years ago, we wouldn't have dreamt of planting because the winters were too cold for it. And it seems like we're starting to get milder winters where we can get trees that are zone 6, where before we would always plant zone 5 trees.
And these are trees like what, Chuck?
The example I got right off the top of my head are crepe myrtles. I'm starting to see in the nursery and in the landscape.
And say those again.
Crepe myrtle.
What is that?
It's a small flowering tree that you'll see all over down south, and now you're starting to see them planted and used in landscapes up here.
Huh. Well, let me get our listeners involved here. If you have questions about the caring for your trees, Chuck will be happy to try it and give you a hand here. You can call us or send us a tweet. Our phone number, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. So what temperature, when it gets really cold, you know, what part of a tree is most susceptible to damage, Chuck? You mentioned the vessels inside. Is that where you're coming down on that one?
Well, I think that part of the problem is don't get all caught up in temperatures, Steve. Here's what can kill trees. Number one is not mulching trees or mulching improperly. The root systems of trees are very delicate. Those feeder roots that bring in water, and it helps to mulch them. Mulching will also protect the trunk so you don't hit it with your weed eater or your son doesn't mow it up with the lawnmower. But mulching needs to be done correctly. It should be 2 to 6 inches away from the trunk. You don't want it touching the trunk.
And everybody pushes it up against the trunk, right?
If your trees have miniature volcanoes around the base, you are actually bringing in disease organisms and rot and letting rodents eat on the bark of the tree where they can hide under that. So you want your mulch not to look like volcanoes, but donuts. You want it 2 to 4 inches deep, starting several inches away from the trunk. And then as far as the tree goes, as far out as you can go, the better for the tree. Trees and turf grass really outcompete each other, and it's hard on the tree. And people go, well, how far do the roots go on a tree? Well, if you stand at the tips of the branches, the roots of a tree can go 2 to 4 times that distance. So number one.
Whoa. So say they get, so you go out to the farthest branch on one side of the tree, and you're saying the roots go way past that.
2 to 4 times that distance if there's soil there available for them to go that way. A lot of times in our urban environments, soil space constricts. There will be roads or buildings where the roots can't go there. But if you put a tree in a field and you stand at the end of the branches, the roots will go 2 to 4 times that distance out from the trunk. So number one is mulching.
But you can't spread your mulch out that far, Chuck. No one's going to do that, are they?
Well, no one's going to do that. But for tree health, the farther you go, the better it is. I would do a minimum of 6 foot. 3 foot on one side, 3 foot on the other side around, so it would be a 6 foot ring.
Oh,
a minimum. And that's on both mature trees and young trees. And the reason you do it for a mature tree is even though it's got a thicker bark, if you continue to hit it with weed eaters and lawn mowers doing that mechanical damage, you are going to run into problems. And basically what will happen is you'll need to remove that tree sooner in its lifespan than it would if you had protected it. So number one is mulching. Number two is pruning. Too many people ask me when to prune, and they're asking the wrong when. The best when to prune on a year-to-year cycle is now. After the leaves fall off in the fall until the buds start to expand and break in spring, dormant pruning is the best time. But the more important when is when in the tree's lifespan to prune. And for that, think of pruning like parenting. You don't start to parent when your child is 20 years old. You parent from 1 to 20 years, and then hopefully you're still going to have that job, but it's going to be much less intense, and hopefully he'll turn out well. It's the same thing with a tree. You want to prune a tree while it's young to train it from the years 1 all the way up to around 20, 30, which is still fairly young for a tree. The main thing is on a large tree, you do not want it to fork. You want it to have one straight trunk or leader going from the base all the way up.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is too many people let the branches stay too low to the ground before they remove them. And then when they finally do need to cut them off because they're tired of mowing grass bent over or they don't have the clearance on the radio, they make huge wounds that make the trunk go hollow. And again, that tree has to come out much sooner during its lifespan than it would if they didn't. So prune early, prune during the winter, and on large trees, you want a single trunk. And as they grow older, you want to remove those lower branches so you will have clearance in the future. And I would suggest a minimum of having your branches start at least 8 foot off the ground for a residential yard tree.
For any kind of tree?
Well, not any kind of tree, because some trees only get 12, 14 foot tall. You
right.
know, flowering dogwood, crab apples.
Yeah.
If you tried to keep the lowest branch at 8 foot, you would have a stick.
Yeah.
So,
right,
but for large maturing trees, a minimum of 8 foot. And most people, if you go drive through an older residential neighborhood and look at their large oaks, and most of them, the first branches are 15,
yes,
20 feet
yes.
or more off.
That's
but,
my house, yeah.
But then look closer and you will see huge
yes.
wounds on the trunks of those trees where they had to have huge branches removed. Branches do not grow up the tree in time. If a branch comes out 5 foot from the trunk 20 years from now, it'll still be 5 foot tall. So remove those lower branches as your tree grows older.
You're actually making this interesting.
Well, thank you.
You're really good at this, Chuck. This is just great. Chuck Connor is my guest. He's an urban forester with the Missouri Department of Conservation. We're talking about tree health as we move into the winters. Some phone calls coming in, 816-235-2888. If you want to join our conversation with your questions about your trees, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Kate from Kansas City, Missouri. Kate, you're on the air with Chuck Connor. Good morning.
I've been listening, and now I have another question, and that has to do with sanitizing the wound from a large limb removal. Isn't there a way to do that, if you have to do it, that would protect that trunk?
The short answer on that is no. It seems like intuitive that it would help if you got like a tar or a latex paint and put on a new pruning wound, because that would keep water from getting in that wound. But in reality, what happens is that cracks in time, water gets in behind it, and it can actually cause it where it doesn't dry out as quick. So there are no wound paints or wound treatments that will keep the large branch removal cut from in time causing a tree to hollow out in the trunk. The only time we recommend using tree paints or tree sprays to mm-hmm. spray those pruning wounds is if you must prune an oak or an elm during the growing season, to immediately treat with those, because there are fungal diseases that are vectored or carried by insects that are attracted to new pruning wounds. So the best thing if you own an oak or an elm is to not prune it till the dormant season when the bugs are asleep or dormant too that carry the disease. But if you have to do light pruning during the growing season, cut a couple branches, then immediately spray with those wound dressings. Don't prune the whole tree and then start spraying, because the bugs that transfer or vector those diseases show up within 15 minutes of the cuts. There are pheromones or chemical compounds that go out on the wind that attract those beetles that carry both Dutch elm disease and oak wilt to your trees. So,
Kate?
All right. This is fascinating. My question, my original, was to ask about winter watering. I lost three hollies and a red Japanese maple last winter. These were 5 to 10-year-old plants. And I had tried to water in late in the winter when we went into a drought, and I'm wondering if that watering had something to do with those deaths.
For your holly on your evergreens, it is especially important if we get a warm-up in the wintertime to water those trees, because they are doing photosynthesis and transpiration all year long. The problem is, though, unless you get a warm-up where the soil's not frozen and you water, it's just running off. You have to have that soil unfrozen so you can get water to percolate down into the ground. On the other hand, both Japanese maples and I'm assuming it was an American holly, but that's an assumption on my part.
Three different kinds, a holly tree and then a couple of large shrubs.
Okay. The evergreens are marginal in our area, and Japanese maple, although is a beautiful tree, is an extremely touchy tree too. None are native to our area, and when you go outside the native plant palette, you've got to sometimes, no matter how much leaven you give them, they still aren't going to make it here.
Mm-hmm.
Fish out of water.
Is it more important to get a good mulch layer that will not be blown away on those types of trees?
Personally, I think mulching is one of the most beneficial, easiest to do correctly, cheapest ways to care for your trees that you can do.
And it's so important. Why?
It moderates soil temperatures. It keeps evaporation from drying your soil out quickly. But the big important thing is it keeps mechanical injury, which I'm meaning brushing them with the lawnmower and the weed eater, away from the stem of those young trees.
Gotcha. Kate, I hope that helped. Thank you.
Oh, very much. Thank you.
You know, a few years ago, on my giant oak tree, you know, very mature tree, you know, dozens and dozens of years old, I had this line of carpenter ants coming off that tree every evening and marching sort of across my driveway. And I was fascinated by it. I was watching it, and I began putting out ant killer stuff. And after a number of weeks, they went away. My question is, if I had carpenter ants coming off that oak, do I have a problem?
The short answer on that is probably not. Carpenter ants don't usually eat enough of the living part of the tissue of that tree to make a difference. They basically use it to make a home in the heartwood, which is the non-living part of the tree that supports it. And they don't excavate enough to weaken the tree.
That was the right answer. I feel better now.
My concern, if
you said it the other way, I would have been in trouble.
My concern on carpenter ants is if they're close to the house, is them actually getting into the house.
That would be more of a concern as far as
your tree goes, Steve.
Carol from Lee Summit. Carol, you're on with Chuck Connor here, urban forester with the Missouri Department of Conservation. It's nice to have you.
Thank you. We own acres of wooded property. We have so many trees that are dead or dying from the drought. We would like to reforest, but we can't water that much property. So three quick things. So what kind of trees can we plant? What time of the year would we plant them? What would grow the fastest? And will cedar trees work in that instance?
Okay, first of all, is it basically you have wooded acreage and some of the trees died and you're wondering if you need to go back in there and replant that to keep your woods, correct?
Yes, it's very depressing.
No. Let's take a step back. First of all, if the drought of 2012, it is going to kill a lot of trees. But if that killed woods, we wouldn't have woods in the state of Missouri or Kansas for that matter, because we get these droughts every 30, 70, 100 years, which is the lifespan of trees. What happens is if you don't manage your trees, and when I mean that, if you don't go in and actively thin your trees, nature does that for you. That's a natural process. So what's occurred is you had, and I'm just guessing here, numbers, let's say 150 trees per acre. Those trees, nature is not a huggy, happy person. Those trees are competing with each other for sunlight, for nutrients, for water, and it is a competition to the death. When you get a catalyst such as the drought of 2012, what that does is that speeds that process. Okay, it's like doubling your wolf pack. And what happens then is those wolves, and this is just a, you know, an example.
You're Mr. Metaphor, aren't
you?
Yes. Yes, you are.
Those wolves are taking out your weaker trees at a much quicker rate than what you're used to. Now, that rate is always there. It's just usually a tree here, a tree there, where the public doesn't recognize it, but it accelerated. So for the quick answers to your questions is – you don't need to replant there. Okay, what happened was the weaker trees died out to make room for the more healthy trees, and I guarantee you, you're going to see more death and decline in those woods. You're going to lose more individual trees. But as long as you don't try to turn it into a park setting and mow the understory, if you let it go, you already have small baby trees on the forest floor and they are going to grow now that those bigger trees have died. They've opened sunlight. It's now reaching the forest floor, and baby trees will now grow much faster to fill that. They're in a race to get that sunlight, nutrients, and water with the other baby trees. So what you have to do is, if you don't convert that land into a Walmart or a shopping center or build homes there, it will remain forest unless you actively manage it not to be forest.
I hope that helps, Carol.
Well, it does tremendously. But one more question. We've always liked cedars, and we've looked at them as like great habitat, you know, for birds' nests. And can those be planted?
Yes and no. You can plant cedars. They do well. It's the only native evergreen we have in the listening area. They make fantastic winter habitat or cover for songbirds. The problem with cedar is they're what's called shade intolerant. They will not deal with shade. Now, when they're young, they can do that. You could plant baby cedars, and you will see them in the woods all the time growing in full shade. But as they mature, they die out because they cannot handle that shade. So, yes, you can plant cedars, but you'll need to plant them in sunlight, not in your woods.
Carol, thank you. Lydia tweeted us this to ask, what types of mulch would you recommend? And can also use compost as mulch for the winter or not?
In fact, recent studies have shown growth rates and tree health. Compost is almost even better than mulch, but mulch in time turns to compost. So I would do, for mulch, you want to use, for lack of a better term, organic or wood-based stuff, pine straw. Compost, hardwood bark. What doesn't make good mulch are rock beds, okay? Mm. Rocks are what you put in the bottom of your barbecue grill to make it hotter. So think what a tree feels like when you put lava rock or rock around it and we get to be 105 in the summertime.
Ah.
So it actually cooks the root systems, and it doesn't have the nutrients. Organic mulches, such as, again, pine straw or cypress mulch or hardwood mulch, it breaks down and turns into compost and releases nutrients into the soil. There's many benefits for that. The only benefit you're going to get from a non-organic, such as rock or rubberized mulch, is the advantage of keeping mechanical equipment such as line trimmers and mowers away from the tree.
Yeah. You know, how about a question that everyone can benefit by, Chuck? How much water do trees need in winter, and how do you know when to water?
Okay. They need, for deciduous trees need much less water in the winter than they do during the growing season because they do not have their leaves on.
Right.
But having said that, your evergreens do because they're still growing, well, not they're still transpiring and they still have those leaves on. So evergreen trees, it's much more important to dedicatedly water those than it is your deciduous trees. Deciduous trees, unless they are newly established where you've planted them just in the last 2 or 3 years, or we've been through a real heavy drought, you probably do not have to water those during the dormant season. But once we start getting into February, March, where things are starting to become active in the tree, if we've been dry, water them good in the spring and then monitor them. Evergreens, especially the non-native ones, are not drought tolerant at all. And if we start to get warm and windy in the wintertime, I don't care how long they've been planted, they are going to need supplemental water from time to time.
And these trees, the watering you're talking about in the springtime, you're talking about the slow watering, right? This is not a heavy deluge.
Yes.
Yeah, you want to.
We have mainly clay soil, and if you try to water quickly, it just all runs off. We've all seen that. You know, you get a downpour for an hour and a half, then you go out and dig, and the top quarter inch of soil is wet, and everything else is powder dry underneath it. So, yes, use either soaker hoses or ooze tubes or gator bags or 5-gallon buckets with small holes, something that will deliver the water to that tree slowly so it has time to percolate down into the root system.
Near the base or out in the edge?
From the base, I don't like watering the trunks. I just don't like to keep that trunk wet. But basically, close to the base, to the tips of the branches. And even though the roots grow farther out than that, if you go from the branch tips in, you're going to get enough water through that rooting zone to keep the tree healthy.
Okay. Well, Chuck Kiner, again, is an urban forester with the Missouri Department of Conservation. Sorry I couldn't get phone calls from Rick and Ron, Rick and Anita and Peter. We'll have Chuck on again sometime soon. Maybe we can talk some more. And Chuck, you were great.
Oh, thank you very much for this opportunity.
You made a great topic, a topic that might be a challenge. Very, very interesting. I sure appreciate it. Time for a break. When we come back, we have a whole lot more. We'll talk about helping birds of prey through landscaping and other topics as well. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Well, if you walk, jog, or ride trails in area parks, there's a good chance you've spent some time on paths built by Urban Trail Co. According to its Facebook page, Urban Trail is dedicated to single-track advocacy, access, and building in the greater Kansas City region for sustainable single-track trail uses. Ben Reed is president of Urban Trail Company. And Ben, thanks for taking some time this morning. Sure good to have you.
Well, no, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, Ben, first off, tell us what a single-track trail is.
Well, a single-track trail is a natural surface trail, typically through the woods.
No concrete, no asphalt, it's rock
and dirt. It looks like it's always been there. That's kind of the goal, is to create something that looks like no one ever touched it. But, of course, that's not exactly how that works.
And why do you guys prefer this kind of trail?
It's simple. It's basic. It is the best way to get people out into a lot of the really beautiful natural areas in this community that they otherwise wouldn't have access to. You know, you go out and you bring machines in and build paved trails or roads, and you disturb the environment, and you really kind of take that natural element out of it. And this is nature at its most basic form.
Well, tell us a little bit about Urban Trail itself. When did you start, and why, and how many members do you have?
Well, the organization was born out of the local mountain bike club back in 2001. The local mountain bike club, Earth Riders Mountain Bike Club, started building trail back in the 90s. In 2001, the decision was made to separate the trail building function with the social club. And at that point, an organization, which it's us, but it's Earth Riders Trails Association, was formed. Earlier this year, we changed our name from Earth Riders Trails Association to Urban Trail Co. The history is essentially there was, this rising need from the advent of mountain bikes to basically provide places for people to use them. And we entered into partnerships with local governments, local landowners to develop trail systems for that purpose.
How many folks are part of your company?
Well, we're a memberless organization. We have a board of directors of 7, and we also have a group of advisory board members, a few dozen people that we communicate with and work with to try to make decisions. We also have a number of trail managers, trail stewards. They're assigned to each individual trail system within the community, and they really do the bulk of the work, and they're the heart of the organization.
So they're volunteers?
Yes, we are a 100% volunteer organization.
Now, a partnership was formed with Kansas City, Missouri. Ben, did you approach the city, or did the city come to you? How did that work?
You know, that's a really good question. I may be wrong about this, but I think they actually approached us. Kansas City, Missouri is one of our newer partners. They would have approached us, or maybe we approached them, but it would have been back in 2007. They wanted some trails built in Swope Park, and we had already done projects with Jackson County, Clay County, Johnson County. And so we went about building trails in Swope Park, and now that's one of our most popular trail systems.
And so when a community comes to you and says, we need help, do you actually go out and design the trail system, or do they say, here's where we want the trails to go, Ben, go at it?
It's a little bit of both. Typically what will happen is we'll either identify a place where we would like to build trail, or some government will come to us and say, you know, we'd like you to build trail here. Could you do it? We'll usually go out and inspect and see if it's something that we think we could do. And a lot of times you'll have some direction in terms of, well, build in this area or don't build in that area. But as far as actually designing the trails themselves, the specific paths, we handle all of that. So everything from the design to the building to the maintenance of the trails, we handle.
Is that a hard set of decisions to make, figuring out where to put a trail?
It can be. It takes a lot of experience. A lot of our earlier trails, I'm thinking of Landell Park over in Jackson County or the Blue River Parkway Trail south of Minor Park, those had to be reworked. Those were some of our earlier trails, and we realized, well, this
Whoops.
Maybe – yeah, yeah, exactly. maybe this wasn't the most sustainable path. Maybe this isn't the best way to do it. And so there's a little bit of trial and error. But, you know, we have trail builders in our organization that have been building since the early 90s, and the people that do it and do it well, it's pretty impressive to watch them do it. They have a pretty good eye for what works and what doesn't.
What are they looking for? Do you have any feel for that?
You know, we want to try to find – interesting terrain, interesting places to go, interesting terrain to go over. We're a little different than, say, building trail in the Rocky Mountains or the Appalachians. There you're trying to find a place you can actually get through the nature. Here, we're kind of looking for hills. We're looking for rocks. We're trying to hit everything we can find. And that's really what it's about. Create something interesting, create something unique that gets people to forget that they're in, you know, the heart of a major American city.
And even though you guys are volunteer, I gather you get paid, right?
No.
You don't get paid?
I don't get paid. No, I have a day job, and I took a little bit of time off today to come talk to you.
And the trail builders don't get paid either?
No, it is 100% volunteer. We pay for their
cities
tools.
Cities like that.
Yeah, they do. It's amazing that they like us so much. I don't know.
What's that about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who maintains the trails once you build them?
We do.
Okay.
Yeah, we do it all.
Once you commit and you build it, you're there for the long haul.
You know, and that's interesting. That's becoming a bit of an issue. It could become a bit of an issue. Let me say that.
500 years from now, Ben?
Right. Yeah. Well, no, it's, you know, right now we've built and we are currently maintaining over 100 miles of trail in the Kansas City area. And
wow.
We're still an all-volunteer organization. And yeah, once we build them, we need to maintain them. And we have plans to build another 100 miles in the next 5 years. So,
and where are those going to go?
A lot of it's going to be an expansion of our already existing trails. I've been talking a little bit about, for example, I've been talking a little bit about Swope Park, and I also mentioned the Blue River Trail south of Minor Park. There are plans, and we are currently in the process of connecting those two trail systems. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to run clear from Swope Park all the way down to about 135th Street. Plans on that aren't finalized, but at the end of the day, that could be 50, 60, 70 miles of continuous trail in the heart of the city.
Yeah.
Cliff Drive is another Kessler Park. There's plans to build somewhere between 10 and 20 miles of trail there. We already have about 2 miles built. So there's pockets of green area in and around the city that we're focusing on building on. Right
How
now.
Long does it take to build a mile of trail? I assume it depends on the terrain and everything else. But
it does. It depends on the terrain. It depends how steep it is.
And the vegetation and everything
right,
else.
Right. In the case of Kessler Cliff Drive, we have to actually get through a lot of trash. It's been a bit of a dumping ground over the past few decades, and that slowed progress there considerably. So it varies from trail to trail.
Yeah. Which city departments do you wind up interacting with?
Almost always the Parks Department. That's who we work with, especially with Kansas City, Missouri. We work with the Kansas City, Missouri Parks Department.
Yeah, and it just works out that way then. Yeah,
that's the natural extension. We tend to build in city parks or state parks, county parks.
I mean, trails are hot right now, right? And there's just this burgeoning sort of interest in more bike trails, more hiking trails,
right.
Walking trails. I mean, you're sort of in a growth industry right now.
True. I mean, cities all around the country are looking to improve the quality of life for their citizens, and trails are a part of that. They provide recreational opportunities that can be unique to a city. You know, I mentioned earlier that we have 100 miles of trail in the metro. I can't think of another major American city that has that. Kansas City is unique in that aspect.
We're visiting with Ben Reed. He's president of Urban Trail Co. And what else goes into a well-made trail, Ben? What kind of work has to be done to make it suitable for, you know, multiple uses these days, which is
right.
So many people are interested in that right now.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that a lot of our earlier trail systems had to be reworked and redesigned, and the problem behind them were they weren't sustainable. You have to be, you know, we want it to resemble a natural trail that animals or people might make in the woods, but we have to make it sustainable so that it can withstand hundreds of users, you know, in a month or a week. And so really what it comes down to is designing the trail so that they shed water and so they don't collect water and they don't erode over time.
Ray wrote us to ask, what are the expected users of the trail? Who are the expected users of trails these days?
Well, like I said, we started out primarily as a mountain bike organization. That's really expanded over the years. If you go out to Shawnee Mission Park or Swope Park, you're going to run into trail runners, people running on the trails. You're going to walk into, you're going to run into hikers. You might run into me walking my dog. It's really just anybody that wants to escape the city.
And Laura emailed us to ask, where can I get a map to view these trails? And do you build bike trails as well?
Well, first of all, to answer the first question, the best place for information on us right now is our Facebook page. Our website is being reworked at the moment. As I mentioned, we just rebranded. All of our maps of our trail systems are available on Google Maps. So just pull up Google Maps, zoom into the parks, and if you see some squiggly lines, that would be us.
And we'll put a link to all this on our website, kcur.org, by the way. Just go to UpToDate. Yeah.
Right. Another resource, if you look at Earth Riders Mountain Bike Club, their website, they actually have a forum section, and they have a forum for each of our trail systems in the city. So you can log onto those forums and get information and even ask the users questions about them. And yes, I do build trail. I build trail primarily out in Kessler Park and some places around Midtown and down in Swope Park as well.
What's the most fun part of building trail?
I think the most fun part is riding or walking a section of trail that you build and knowing what went into it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the biggest hurdles we have is people think that these trails just exist and nobody really did anything to get them to be how they are. And when you actually build them, you realize that nothing could be further from the truth.
You know, people are going to be wondering as we're talking here, Ben, if people want to volunteer and get involved, they can do that how?
The best thing to do is to follow our Facebook page. We have work days, especially this time of year on the weekend. We had work days at Hodge Park and I believe on the connector section between Swope and the Blue River Parkway trails this weekend. This next Saturday, we have work days at Smithville Lake and Kessler Park.
Can anybody just come out?
Anybody can come out. Just show up. Just bring some sturdy shoes, long pants, and gloves, and you're ready to go. So.
Carolyn wrote us this to ask you, ask Ben about the Rozarks. It's a really cool project.
Yeah, that is. The Rozarks is a trail project that we are doing in the Midtown area of Kansas City, Missouri, and also Kansas City, Kansas. What we're doing is we've taken a lot of these parks that have been neglected over the years. A lot of them are located in lower income areas, and we've worked with a lot of community organizations to remove invasive species, to clean up the trash, and to provide trail systems through these places and to really bring them back into public use. Some of the places are Rosedale Park, Roanoke Park, Mount Marty. The Mount Marty system is actually really impressive, the transformation that particular park has undergone over the past two or three years.
Yeah. Well, Ben Reed, again, is president of Urban Trail Co. And, Ben, so good to have you, and thanks for all your good work, your good volunteer work, for that matter.
Well, thank you.
You bet. Thanks for coming in. Well, the work that Urban Trail Co. Does got us curious about partnerships between Kansas City and private organizations. Joining us now to talk a little bit more about it is Chris Hernandez, who's director of city communications for the city of Kansas City, Missouri. And Chris, always good to have you here. Welcome.
Hey, great to see you again, Steve.
How unique is the association that Urban Trail Co. has with the city, and are there others like it, or?
Yeah, of course there are. And we do a lot of public-private partnerships, and what's really great about this is part of that is harnessing the passion of some of these groups when they see a need or they want to help provide a service. And the city can't be everything to everyone, but this is a way that we can expand our reach in terms of providing services that some people would say is a basic service.
Yeah.
Other people might not see a trail as a basic service because they're more interested in their curb or their sidewalk on their block. But we want to try to provide a broad range of services. And this is a great way to harness that energy and that passion and create a system of trails in our city parks that are a benefit to a lot of people.
But certainly you have to sign off on the work they want to do. If they were out there hacking stuff to death, there'd be some issues, I assume. Here,
yeah,
right?
And so we have some folks at the Parks Department that they worked with certainly at the front end to arrange the partnership and to help them decide where the trails can actually be placed.
Mm-hmm.
Ben and I were talking earlier, and while they do all the maintenance of the trails, there are certainly our staff at the parks who, like on a day like today, would go out and say, put up an open or close sign on the trail depending on the weather.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys check the work that Urban Trail Co. does on a regular basis?
I would expand that out to, not just their organization
course,
or their work,
course.
But we are constantly evaluating public-private partnerships and the work that they do because another example with another basic service, striping the crosswalks. Years ago, the city did that, then decided, you know what? We need to contract that out and have a private company paint the crosswalks. Did that for a while, but in the realm of constantly reviewing and evaluating, decided, you know what? We can probably do it better and more efficiently and save money by bringing it back in-house. So we did. So those sorts of things happen because with any of the public-private partnerships that we have, we're always watching, evaluating, and seeing what works, what doesn't, and adjusting.
The fact that Urban Trail Co. doesn't charge you any money has got to be a huge plus in their favor here, right?
Oh, absolutely. And because they are committed, I mean, talking about that maintenance, I mean, that is a track record of going out there and making sure that they are helping and following through on their end of the deal.
Yeah. How likely is working with organizations like Urban Trail Corps likely to be a model of cooperation the city is going to continue to look forward to going forward here?
I think it's something that we have done for years.
Yeah.
And moving forward, we're really going into a new realm. We're talking about a very physical thing here, a park trail. One of the newest things we're doing is really looking at innovation and technology. On our website, we have the Open Data Catalog. And one of the reasons we have put all of the city data into a very transparent place, the Open Data Catalog, where entrepreneurs can go and look at the data when they're thinking about new services and needs in our new economy and saying, how can we make something work? How can we find a new way of doing something? So whether it's they want to create an app that's going to help with a city service and bring that to us as a possibility, it's really interesting. We're on this new frontier of looking at data and technology and creating public-private partnerships out of that information, just as we continue to provide the basic services in a very physical way like a trail.
And you guys probably need help with some of that too, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the world's changing so quickly, you can't do it all on your own.
Yeah, and that's what's great about Kansas City. We have this incredible entrepreneurial spirit here, but we also have this tech scene that is just really coming alive right now, and we're wanting to encourage that. That's why we have the Open Data Catalog and things like that.
So if people want to connect with the city and help in the same way that Ben's organization is helping, who should they contact and how much of a proposal should they work up before they come see you?
Well, that's a great question. And there are a lot of different ways to do that because clearly a lot of people are already doing that by going through their council member or the mayor's office. They have a contact page on their website. You can come through communications and we can help steer you to the right person. Bottom line, you have to have the support of the council and the mayor, and you have to go through the city manager's office for some vetting on that. And keep in mind, some of these are really small projects. Some of these are really huge projects. We even consider Google Fiber as a public-private partnership because of the way we're helping them by waiving permit fees and expediting permits, and they are helping us as a city by putting in all those free connections in the libraries and community centers and schools.
Chris Fernandez is a spokesman for the city of Kansas City. Chris, it's always good to have you here. Thanks for coming in, man.
Sure.
Appreciate it. As human development expands, the natural habitat of many animals is destroyed or altered so that it becomes unable to support the wildlife it once did. Among those affected are raptors, birds of prey that need open grasslands or forests in which to hunt and live. As more businesses are built on the edges of urban areas, the land of raptors suffers habitat destruction. A researcher from the University of Missouri has found that with some changes to landscaping approaches, businesses can help preserve these species of birds that include eagles, hawks, falcons, and kestrels. Here to talk about his research is Charles Nylon. He is president of Fisheries and Wildlife at the MU College of Agriculture, Food, and Natural Resources. Charlie, welcome to Up to Date. Good to have you.
Thank you, Steve.
What prompted you to look into this, Charlie?
Well, our project came from some work that we started at the University of Missouri in cooperation with Missouri Research Park, which is one of the University of Missouri system's research sites, and it's basically a business park in St. Charles County, Missouri. And we got started with this because one of the tenants at Missouri Research Park, Novus International, which is a St. Louis-based company, decided that they wanted to do a project to improve their corporate campus for wildlife habitat. And as part of that, we started looking at ways they might do that. And this led to a bigger project done by Jonathan Hoag, who was a grad student at the University of Missouri up here in Columbia, who wanted to do a research project looking at raptors.
So what did the two of you set out to do, and what kind of data were you going to collect in the process of that?
Well, our goal in the project was to first look at places that different raptor species might use as roosting habitat or nesting habitat. And so we wanted to get data first on where people actually saw raptors. So the very first thing Jonathan did was he sent out a survey to a number of people in the St. Louis area involved with birding and said, where do you see raptors that you think might be nesting? Where do you see them during the breeding season and so on around the St. Louis area? And then from that, we developed the study. So we decided we looked at a range of research parks and business parks, which ranged in location from those right in downtown St. Louis all the way out into St. Charles County. So the first thing we did was Jonathan went out and he went to all of these sites and he did what's called a playback. So he had a tape that had different kinds of calls on the different raptor species, and he would play that for a certain time period, then look to see how birds responded. So the idea is that the birds hear the call, they say, oh, somebody's here is like me, and they respond to it. And so that's what we did, the counts. Then the second thing we did was we did some assessment using aerial photographs of all the business parks to see what the habitat features were. That is, how much vegetation, how much lawn, how many trees, and how much built space was in each of these office parks. And we used that to try to relate that to the kinds of birds we saw at each business park.
That's interesting. We're visiting with Charles Nylon. He's a professor of fisheries and wildlife at the MU College of Agriculture, Food, and Natural Resources. Charlie, how did you go about determining if raptors were even in a particular area where businesses had moved in?
Okay, well, what we did was, as I mentioned, the first thing we did was we sent out a survey to a lot of people who were involved in birding in the St. Louis area, and we asked where there were raptor nests. And so we identified probably 10 or 15 places where we thought birds were actually nesting. Then the other thing we did was Jonathan used a protocol where we first located business parks in the St. Louis area. We used a zoning map to do this, and we also talked with people in St. Louis City, St. Louis County, and St. Charles County in their planning department to identify the locations. Then we went out to each of these places. So we visited about probably over 100 locations in St. Louis County, St. Charles County, and St. Louis City over 2 summers, and actually went out to each of these places, and we visited the sites. Jonathan did his playback recordings for the different raptor calls, and we actually looked to see if we saw birds or heard birds responding to the call, different calls we played back.
What correlations have you found between, you know, how a business or business park was landscaped and the number of raptors that remain in the area?
Okay. Well, one thing we found was that first, different species like different kinds of habitat features. So, for example, kestrels, which are one of the more common raptors to see in the city, actually like places that have a lot of lawn or grass. So for that particular species, the business parks that retained a lot of just open space, of green space, tended to be used by kestrels more. They like kind of open, scattered trees and lots of grass or lawn. We found that other species have different requirements in terms of more trees and so on. And that information is pretty well known. But what we found in general was that the places where the area around the business park had more green space, more natural landscape, and that kind of thing, those kinds of sites tended to have a wider range of species, and we also had a wider range of species and often more detections of just raptors in general.
What makes an area attractive to these types of birds? What have you found there?
Okay. Well, I think a couple things. One is that most raptors, you know, they're birds which do a lot of their hunting and those kind of things by sight. So the configuration of trees, of grass, of those kinds of things is real important. The one thing I think we found would be probably the best message, say, to a planner or landscape architect or somebody like that is that if you minimize the amount of pavement, the amount of built-up surface, and those kinds of things, that's a really important thing to do. So if you just think about the sort of campus and the site of the development you're working on, if you can minimize the amount of built space, that's going to be important to raptors, first of all. And then the second thing we found was that different species obviously have different requirements. So like red-tailed hawks are different. Red-tailed hawks will often use places like the MU campus here in Columbia. You see red-tailed hawks roosting, and they'll be able to, and they depend a lot more on trees and those kinds of things for where they're going to be found. Then you have other species which require more open space. So we found that there's some very specific things for some species, but in general, it's leaving that amount of green space and leaving some areas as less developed or less built up.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, Charles Nylon, again, is a professor of fisheries and wildlife at the MU College of Agriculture, Food, and Natural Resources. Charlie, thanks for the update. Interesting work. I'm glad you joined us. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for inviting me, Steve. Thank you very much.